Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Welcome to episode 700 of the IGN UK podcast. We did something incredibly special and didn't just pull this out at the last minute. It's the two Matts, and it's also the first episode of Wes. Hi, how's it going? Welcome.
Good, thank you. Yeah, the first episode of Wes is something I might have written when I was a kid on a piece of paper once and just left it behind. But yeah, it's quite intimidating to be here and know that people might be listening, so hopefully I don't mess it up.
It's horrifying and it never gets any easier.
The greatest thing though is this is the best IGN podcast out of all of them, because A, we get to speak about everything, we're not platform specific, and it's the one where you can be a little bit salty if you're a bit angry about something.
We'll say a rude word, no one can stop us.
It's the British way.
Yeah, absolutely. So Wes, if you want to give people a little bit of background, like, you know, people might have heard about you before, might have seen some stuff that you've done. Yeah.
Well, I presume. I'm the IGN's new UK news editor, and I used to work for a UK video game website called Eurogamer. I worked there for 13 years in various different roles, mostly focusing on news. And if I'm known for anything in the industry, I guess it's for investigative reporting, original reporting, interviews, that sort of thing. So when the opportunity came up to do some of that for IGN, I just couldn't say no. I mean, it's IGN, right? So,
that's what everybody says.
Yeah. Well, I am genuinely thrilled. And this is like, for me, this is day five. And there's been a lot to wrap my head around, but it's been a lot of fun.
You have been thrown into the deep end this week, which we will get into shortly. But first, every time that somebody joins the show, we have to ask them three very important questions, of which the first one is, what is your favourite game?
I mean, this one was easy to think about because I've thought about this relatively recently, Street Fighter. And I say Street Fighter as a sort of like collective franchise, because Street Fighter 2 was the one that, you know, grabbed me, but I don't think anyone in their right mind would go, I'm going to play Street Fighter 2 now. I mean, it's not a good game to play in, you know, 2023.
It's just so slow, and it's all special moves. There's no normals. There's no, you know.
Well, it's just, you know, the balance is ridiculous. You know, you can, you know, kill someone in a few hits. It's just, you know. But, you know, obviously it's iconic and influential and, you know, defined my childhood, really. I grew up in South London, and I would play Street Fighter after school almost every day in Streatham Mega Bowl, and just in a relatively brutal environment where it was a very intimidating sort of atmosphere.
And how you get good.
I was
fear is the biggest motivator.
And just trying to learn from people who I thought were like genuine gods at Street Fighter, who probably in the grand scheme of things weren't, but to me was just so incredible. And I'll never forget seeing two people sat at the cabinet in Mega Bowl and Streatham each of them picked Zangief, and the rule was, and there's a massive crowd around the cabinet, the rule was the round would kick off, both Zangiefs would sort of like trundle towards each other, and the first player to land the spinning pile driver would win the match. Literally, that was the end. The person who lost had to get up and go to the back of the queue. And that was sort of my trial by fire with Street Fighter 2 back in the day.
If you could even hit the SPD, were you the god? Like the people that just like... I love the idea that that's like something that you had to pass down as well. Be like, because it's not a move that you do like accidentally as well. Like
no,
you
don't no.
Spin, yeah.
Well, my... I can't remember exactly which birthday it was, but we rented a Japanese SNES from the local video shop with Japanese Street Fighter 2, which obviously came out long before Street Fighter 2 came out here. And I was one of the greatest days of my life. And had a birthday party where I I just played Street Fighter in front of everyone. And I remember everyone sort of left after the party was over, and I was still sat there playing Street Fighter 2 on the SNES. And I remember the manual was all in Japanese, and I was going through all the characters trying to learn their special moves. But because the manual was in Japanese, I couldn't decipher everything. And I couldn't quite work out how to do Zangief spinning pile driver. I saw it, you know, the computer do it to me. I was like, how is that done? Couldn't work it out from the manual. And I just remember getting so upset and trying all sorts on that horrible SNES D-pad to the point where my thumb was bleeding. And my parents said, right, you have got to stop. And I was like, I can't work it out. I can't do this thing. What do I do? That was, Street Fighter 2 was just, yeah, it's in my veins.
Kids these days, with like how good Street Fighter 6 is, and we'll get onto that a little bit later on the episode, but just how good it is at like putting all of that stuff forward. Like I know frame data based on just playing the video game now. Like we never had that stuff back in the day.
I know.
It's ridiculous.
I'm not sure I even knew what it was back in the day.
Yeah. All right, and the other question we ask too is, what is your favorite film of all time?
I think it's probably, like, if I want to sound cool, it's probably The Matrix. Not just because of what it was and how cool it was when it came out, but the age I was when it came out. You know, I was I just started university. I was 18. The Matrix came out, and it sort of blew my mind as a concept, let alone as a movie. And it was incredibly influential. But you know, I've got a guilty pleasure. That is actually my secret favorite movie of all time. And it's Hackers.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen Hackers.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But it's kind of terrible high school coming of age movie where Angelina Jolie is one of the coolest like characters in any movie of all time and has a sort of love-hate relationship with John Lee Miller's character. They save the world through hacking. It's ridiculous, but... It's such a fantastic, you know, movie to watch for fun, just as you know, having a bit of a laugh, and it's very silly, but also I just love it. I love it to bits.
No, I feel like Hackers really defined an era of like what I was interested in media, and maybe even still today. Like, I just love that kind of like not very self-serious, but also incredibly serious at the same time.
Yeah,
like, that's the tone I kind of strive for in everything. Yeah, Hackers rocks. If you've never seen it at home.
The music is fantastic, you know, there's hacker music on it, you know, Prodigy and, you know, all this stuff. And the scene that I always remember as being, like, I remember seeing it going, holy crap, I wish I could do that in real life, was at one point they're in the hallway in high school and John Lee Miller and Angelina Jolie are having this sort of hacker battle to try and one-up each other. They love each other, really, but... John Lee Miller's hacked the school sprinkler system, and he puts up an umbrella in the middle of the corridor, and it all start all the sprinkler turns on and it soaks everyone. And Angelina Jolie is absolutely furious that he's sort of done this to her, but you can also tell that she's like, oh my god, you're so hot right now.
hacking Riz. I love it. And finally, final question, what's your favorite TV show?
Yeah, I mean, everything I've said so far has really aged me, but it's X-Files, and it's very specific. It's X-Files not just because it's a fantastic show in of itself, but also because it was my first sort of like experience of fandom, like the sort of on earliest online speculation-y type, what does this mean, you know, episode to episode. And it was so crude back then, you know, it was almost impossible to have any meaningful conversation with anyone over the internet.
There were no wikis at the time, so if you wanted to like look up a piece of information,
boards of people arguing what over black goo meant.
Exactly.
Not even Chris, the guy that wrote it, really knew what the black goo was.
So much fun to be involved in all that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna break your heart by telling you this, but it's coming up to 30 years since that show aired for the first time. It's this year.
There's an almost daily basis, someone says something that I love is turning 30. And I can't, it's like I'm immune to the crumble to dust feeling at this point. You know, I mean, if it's not Street Fighter, it's Matrix or it's something else. Yeah. You know? It's like, it's all, everything I love is coming up 30. It's great. Brilliant.
Do you have a favorite episode, Wes?
My favorite episode is the ridiculous freak show episode, which is like the comedy episode.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One, because my favorite episodes in it are the ones that are the monster episodes, the monster of the week episodes, the ones that are in isolation. And that one is very much there. But I think it's one that's has stood the test of time, perhaps better than the others, because it's a rare sort of like... instance of them letting their hair down a little bit, because X-Files are so super serious and oh my god, you know, the conspiracy and everyone's in danger and you know what's the truth. And then we had this episode where it is genuinely like taking the piss out of David Duchovny almost every scene, and he's well up for it, like he's clearly having a lot of fun. And I just every now and again I rewatch that episode and I just think how brilliant that era was, where it was like, you know, genre defining entertainment, but also everyone was having a bit of a laugh and it was quite fun. And I was like, yeah, it's just really nice to think about.
Yeah, there's those occasional episodes where you say it lets their hair down. That's not the one with Cher in it, is it? Is that the postmodern Prometheus that's got Cher in it, where there's just like a big musical number at the very end?
No, I don't think that's that one.
Mm-hmm.
The end of that episode, there's someone from the circus who has this wonderful monologue moaning about David Duchovny being this like pillar of mandom, and and David Duchovny is just sort of standing there, you know, with his hands on his hips, looking out into the distance, clearly like, you know, taking the piss out of himself, and it's just really great. I love it.
Yeah, I remember like there was a before kind of like, you know, I do love it all the way through, but it does go a bit off the deep end in the last couple of seasons, but before it gets there and it's hit that stride of confidence where it knows that like we can throw in like a really daft episode here or there. There's one that's almost entirely about him like dealing with the fact that like someone slips on a banana pie at some point and it's all about a murder that runs around there. It's so good. When it's good, it's real damn good.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you know, it can go from that to some of the most iconic horror on telly. Like everyone remembers Tombs, who is like, you know, top 10 TV villains, I think. So, yeah, I mean, it's got it all. I love it. Conspiracy, sci-fi, great characters, great acting. And nostalgia, obviously, for me now. No, it's 30 years old.
Is there anything recent that, like, holds a candle to it, in your opinion?
Well, I think the sense of speculation online about what's going to happen next or what things mean has come to be almost like the defining aspect of everything, let alone TV. Like everything is a franchise. Everything teases something else. And I think, you know, I'm kind of sick of it. And I'm like, you know, I don't think I'm anything that I'm watching now that has got like is very obviously trying too hard to be setting things up at every moment. You know, X-Files did it effortlessly first. And it's very hard for me to... There's not much that I'm seeing. I will say that I'm watching Silo on Apple TV at the moment. and Silo, which is I'm fearful it's not not enough people are watching it to justify a second season, because it is wonderful. It's based on books. There'll be people who know the story and what is actually going to happen and all the rest of it. But I haven't.
I'm a big fan of the books. I've not watched it yet. I'm waiting to watch it all in one block with my partner. I love the books.
Well,
I'm just excited to find out what's in that silo. Is it grain? Is it
a whole lot of mystery? I think it's tremendous, and it does the whole what's going on here thing in a very sort of like considered, confident, relaxed manner, where you're not, always being battered over the head with, what could this mean? Silo for me is really itching that X-Files-y conspiracy. He's really scratching that itch for me right now.
Yeah, maybe we've got to give Silo a little look. It's evaded me so far. I'm well aware that it's out, but yeah.
This is what I'm worried about. Everyone's like, oh yeah, I should watch Silo. No one's watching it.
And it's Apple's, what happens with Apple's TV like, shows too. Like, TV shows never take off until like the second season, at least, maybe as well. Like, people are like, oh, people don't watch TV until they have to, right? They need enough people going like, oh, all right, go on, I will then.
I do think it's in the safest place. Like, Apple are putting tremendous amounts of money into sci-fi at the moment. Like, they've got the biggest kind of budget sci-fi shows and real wacky concept work. Like, the fact that they made Severance work is wild to me, but like, that's definitely going ahead. So I think it's in the safest place it could be. It's on a channel that no one watches to begin with, so
so the only way is up, right?
Are bad. It doesn't matter.
I mean, they did Foundation, which is just, I can't believe someone made anything out of Foundation. And actually the first Foundation isn't that great, I don't think. But that's getting a second season. It starts next month. And so if Foundation, which I thought was mostly crap, is getting a second season, hopefully Silo, which is mostly superb, will as well. And that thing you were saying about throwing money at these things is absolutely right. Silo looks incredible. It looks so expensive, like
said that they were making it, because I've got obviously in my head what this place looks like, have had for three books, and I was like, oh, I didn't know who they were going to shop it out to begin with. And then when they said it was Apple and I'd seen what other things that Apple had made, it was like, okay, there's going to be HBO grade money involved in this. It's going to look good.
It looks like really convincing. Well, it looks like a silo under the ground in which 10,000 people have lived for generations, and that's a crazy thing to challenge people to create for a TV show without it being like this horrible CGI mush. And they do a fantastic job. It must have been an absolute nightmare. Foundation looks fantastic as well. It looks like they spent millions and millions on it as well. So they're putting their money where their mouth is. I just hope, I'll bang that Silo drum. I want more people to watch it. I want more Silo. So.
Well, speaking about getting people enthusiastic for things that they haven't got an opportunity to check out yet.
There's the secret question. There's the last question.
Oh, no, you didn't tell me about this one. There's another one.
Oh, is it the... Oh, of course. I forgive me. Have you seen The Prestige and do you like it?
I haven't seen The Prestige, so I don't know if I like it.
Oh, it's a very important watch. I think that we might need to put it on as part of the hiring practice.
Really? Is this the thing where you decide if someone's allowed to stay, whether or not they like Prestige, right?
Pretty much, basically.
Am I supposed to like it or am I supposed to hate it?
Well, I think by at least your 6-month review, you will have need to have seen The Prestige.
Yeah, but I need to have the right opinion, though, if I want to stay on, right? So I'll do a bit of digging, find out which is the right sentiment.
You've got 700 podcasts to listen back to. I don't know when the Prestige thing started on the podcast.
I don't know either.
Somewhere around Gav's beginnings, I think. But
yeah, it's a good movie. And he's not around it. We could decide that we don't like the Prestige.
We could just
unfortunately,
decide
I
that
do think
a new,
it's a good movie.
Yeah, we could just decide that there's a new mandatory movie for the podcast. It doesn't have to be the Prestige.
You know what? I'm going to say it now. The new thing is that everybody's favorite show has got to be Silo. Every episode we've got to talk about how much we love Silo.
I mean, I would be down with that. I tell you what, I promise that I will watch Prestige and have some hot take that's like 20 years too late for the next time I'm on one of these things if I'm allowed back.
Yeah, you're in for a treat. It's a pretty good movie. Well, We also got treated to a bunch of new reveals from Big Jeff. Big Jeff had his night at the Summer Game Fest. A lot of like interesting stuff, but a lot of stuff that we've seen before.
It was good to get things like, you know, to be told when Spider-Man's coming out. A mere, what is it, like 3 days after Alan Wake or something like that? It's like, just stop it, please.
It is a massive month. Yeah. Like right now, early on in the year, we're even struggling to keep up with all the stuff that's coming out. Yeah. And like by the end of it, it's, absolutely
what I will say is, I only mean stop it by please stop putting the releases so close together. I really want to play Alan Wake and I really want to play Spider-Man. And it's basically going to be Alan Wake because I love Remedy and it's coming first. But I can't wait to play a lot of these things.
I think Assassin's Creed is out.
That was right.
And I have played every single Assassin's Creed to completion, so it's another thing to try and fit into this kind of gap. I just need to give up playing games, basically. That's clearly the answer.
Can you, like, maybe early retirement, perhaps?
This is not a new phenomenon. Like, I remember when my very first month as a professional games journalist was September 2007.
And that's when every game came out. That was BioShock.
Every week, and, every single week was another like banger. Every single week, Mass Effect. Modern Warfare, the first Modern Warfare. Halo
the
3.
Darkness came out that year.
these are all like 1 week after the other, like Crysis, Rock Band, you know, Mario Galaxy. It was just mad. It was like, and no one was. Everyone was like, wow, this is great, you know.
Games are good forever. Little did we know.
That was my first year at university, and I can remember spending a lot of student loan on games and also very quickly realizing I needed to get a part-time job to supply this games habit.
Yeah, but I bet you'll have had a lot of time to play them though, right?
I played so much Rock Band that year. I can remember bringing Rock Band home from the local HMV and getting trapped in the turnstile to my halls of residence and having to have a security guard come and let me through. But good God, did that Rock Band kit get a workout. I played that so much. Me and my mates, almost every day.
Did you snap the pedal, by the way?
No,
that's the real marker.
I had a good drummer. He knew what to do with that pedal.
I did the, you had to get like, because, you know, we couldn't just replace it. I'd already spent all the money on the Rock Band kit. I had to do the two knives trick where you like, you use them as like a splint to keep the pedal going. That's how much Rock Band I played.
That's a great hack, that, isn't it? Like, old school hacks, turning things upside down and putting things on pedals. that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know, we just didn't have replacements. You know, again, kids just don't know how good they've got it these days. You couldn't order a separate pedal too. You had to buy the kit again. That was the thing. Ugh. Anyway, enough nostalgia. We're looking forward to the future, of which we got our first look at Mortal Kombat 1's Cameo Fighters. Is it just Street Fighter that tickles you? The fighting game fantasy, or is it?
I mean, it's really funny because you were saying, you know, enough of nostalgia, let's look to the future. Mortal Kombat 1! which is like a reboot, and based on what I'm a massive Mortal Kombat fan, I should say. Love it to bits. Played the last one a lot. Really fussed over getting good online, all that kind of stuff. And this one is definitely a nostalgia play, right? It's a reboot because it. Mortal Kombat just spiralled out of control. The story, generally speaking, the single player campaign mode in Mortal Kombat's very good. But it just got completely impossible to understand. And if I'm struggling, like, and I'm trying to keep up, you know, I can't, like, any newcomer would be like, what the hell is this? And so, yeah, their decision to basically start again, which is what they're doing, I think is a good one. I hate the title of it, Mortal Kombat 1. It's just
bad flashbacks to Battlefield 1, which always felt weird. Such a weird choice.
Yeah, I just don't like the way it sounds. You know, nothing should have the one. I think maybe I'm a journalist and I'm always like, cut the superfluous words, right? And one is superfluous to me. It's just in my
That's giving
bones.
Me Justin Timberlake from The Social Network flashbacks. cut the one, just Mortal Kombat.
Someone should have put their arm around Ed Boon at some point and said, look, mate, murder your darlings. You do not need this one at the end of Mortal Kombat. I actually think Mortal Kombat would have been fine. because people, well, they just say, have you played the new Mortal Kombat? Have you played, you know, and Mortal Kombat is,
call it that.
You know, the new Mortal Kombat.
Yeah.
That would have been better than Mortal Kombat 1. But yeah, they've got like, I saw from the trailer, they've got famous characters in their costumes that people remember from the original Mortal Kombat, like Kano, Sonya Blade, and, you know, calling them in as cameo, like the cameo with a K.
I love it.
I
although
love
not
it.
To be confused with the Xbox 360 game.
Oh, yes. Well, so, like, Ed Boon in interviews has always told people, look, don't think about it too much, right? Well, it's Mortal Kombat. We were just having a laugh. And I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely right. People should not take this stuff too seriously. However, Johnny Cage is spelt with a C.
Mm-hmm.
So if the curly cur doesn't exist in the Mortal Kombat universe, how is Johnny Cage not spelt with a K? They really, it's always bothered me. I'm like, you know,
think they'd use the rebooting of the universe as the opportunity to force that in, wouldn't you?
Fix your problems. Yeah, I know, but yeah, I like the cameo stuff. Looks like a really accessible combo extending opportunity, which I think could be a lot of fun. Like, it's obviously, I think Ed Boon mentioned it on stage, you can't spam this stuff, it's metered. So when you're calling people in, it's going to be, you're going to have to sort of govern that and manage that and think about when you're doing it. But yeah, it's really nice, you know, change from Mortal Kombat and, you know, giving me some sort of like Marvel vs. Capcom vibes. And, you know, I think he also said that a lot of the cameo characters will be, you know, they're going to dig into, like, you know, other Mortal Kombat games, pull characters out that haven't been seen in years. There'll be a lot of, like, deep cuts and nods to stuff for fans, and those cameo characters will be for that, which is great. But he also said you can pick Sub-Zero to play as and also pick Sub-Zero as a cameo. So you can have like Sub-Zero...
double ice blasts. Yeah.
And I think that is perfect, right? Because Mortal Kombat shouldn't be, you know, it should be just stupid and silly and, you know, anything goes. And if it doesn't make sense, whatever, you know. So, yeah, I really like the look of it.
Yeah, I was convinced that the cameo fighters weren't going to be part of the regular cast. Because it's weird that I think that Johnny Cage is only being a cameo one, which is, you know, strange to not have Johnny Cage of all people as part of your main cast, but maybe later on down the line.
I'm pretty sure Johnny Cage will be playable. Like, mm-hmm. he's too big a deal to not have that. I mean,
this is just rumoured, by the way, I should say. I don't have any inside sources. But,
yeah. Well, I think they said Jean-Claude Van Damme,
mm-hmm.
his likeness and voice, his real voice, will be a Johnny Cage skin.
That rocks.
Which is it's brilliant, isn't it? It's so wonderful. Now, you don't sell that for a cameo-only character.
Mm-hmm. Right?
People will buy it because they want to play as Jean-Claude Van Damme in Mortal Kombat, and if it's just a cameo character, they're leaving money on the table. Warner Brothers never leaves money on the table. So,
if you can trust anything in this world... we also got a look at, and I'm convinced this is never coming out through some like reason or another, but Pal World got a trailer at this, which, yeah.
What a bizarre idea this is. I can remember the first trailer for this, which was like last year sometime, and just by the burnt memory of that is just a sequence in which a load of Pokemon are building M16s in a factory, mm-hmm. like little gun slaves. Not as dark this time around on there, but yeah, this, as you say, this doesn't feel like is a game that could possibly make it to market.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, maybe will be very different than what we expect it to be based on, you know, we've seen no mechanics, no anything other than kind of just some CGI stuff, but it's a hell of a sell.
It basically just wildly looks to be like a Nintendo, like, lawsuit waiting mm-hmm. to happen.
They're like, you would do a double take and you would think it was a Pokemon. Like, it's mm-hmm. not even, it's so similar, but I guess just legally distinct enough.
It looks like, to me, something someone would build in Roblox.
Yeah.
Like, I remember seeing it thinking, you know, that's not going to be a game someone releases. It's going to be something that you just download from within another platform, like maybe Fortnite's creation thing or whatever. And then someone will get upset and make it go away. And that'll be the end of it. But it's an actual game that appears to be happening.
maybe, maybe it will come out. Right, and I'll give the two of you the floor for this one. Space Marine 2.
Yay! It's fucking finally on its way.
Oh, man.
So I'm delighted to be able to say to everyone that I have been joined by another Warhammer 40k fan on the podcast. Wes knows his shit when it comes to Adeptus Astartes. So, Wes, what did you think of the trailer?
Well met, brother. I thought it looked fantastic. I mean, this isn't our first look at the game. We've seen clips of gameplay before, and it's looked fantastic there. But it looks even better now. And also, the announcement of three-player co-op is just a wonderful feature for them to have. And I can definitely see myself spending a lot of time stomping around that world, smashing Tyranids to bits. It looks like they've really got that, nailed the atmosphere, the bigness of 40K. Because 40K is, you know, I've always thought it's other things other than the tabletop and the lore side of things have really struggled to properly translate the universe just because it's so enormous. The scale of it, battles, unit size, you know, the scope of it, you know, galaxy wide stuff. But this has got that big play spaces, you know, a tight squad of Space Marines, you know, swarms of Tyranids. Like the Tyranid swarm tech looks fantastic. This is from the same developer behind World War Z,
and that you can tell that it was absolutely what is the like Xenos enemy from Warhammer that best matches the swarm tech from World War Z. It's like, it was the Tyranids, isn't it?
It is, absolutely.
Like, absolute perfect match for that tech.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And for some, like, I love, there's, you know, there's this thing, like, people are like, there's too many Warhammer 40k games, or just generally Warhammer games. There just seems to be, like, a new one announced every week. I think we're actually in the golden age of Warhammer games, because most of them are pretty good.
We're at a point now where it's like really strong developers have actually got hold of the license now.
Yeah, there's some good ideas.
They might convince me to get Rogue Trader when it comes out. Mm-hmm. Like, it looks good. I really want to check it out. And I don't care about 40K at all.
Yeah, I've been playing a little bit of Boltgun, which is obviously, it's only made by Auric Digital, so very small kind of company from Bristol. But they did an absolutely tremendous job of kind of like making a boomer shooter in that. And the really lovely thing about it is it's set on the planet from the original Space Marine. So it's almost like this lovely little link between the original Space Marine and Space Marine 2. All of the kind of like little, that's the thing is when you get a developer that understands the writing and the lore, is they gets the scale, understands like how to, because 40k is almost like half tragedy, half comedy, right? Like, it's so big and absurd that it's very, very silly, but it's also completely like self-serious about itself, and that's where the beauty of that universe comes. And I think we've really found some developers now that actually understand how to convey that, and you can see that in spades in that trailer for Space Marine 2.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the heft of the Space Marine looks really good. Like, it's really difficult to make a Space Marine in movement look unlike Buzz Lightyear. It's like, because when you think about it, the suit is the same,
yeah.
and the movement is kind of, you know, physics defying. You know, the idea that if this can be a thing is kind of stupid in the first place. But they've actually done a really good job of making it look like it's quite. He's not going to be like, you know, falling with style or that sort of thing. He's going to be like making his way through a place, like, and applying real force to things. And I think that's the trick, because Space Marines are supposed to be tanks. They're like people in like that are tanks. And if they're sort of like floaty, or they don't have any sort of like the right audio behind things, or if they, even if the camera isn't in the right place to sort of make diminish their sort of impact, it'll just fall really flat. And what I've seen of the trailer, what I've seen previously, I think they really understood that they need to nail just that weight, that impact that a Space Marine should have. I could talk about this for a long time with you.
In short, Matt, we really like the look.
I remember playing Space Hulk when it came out, because I was really into XCOM beforehand, and I just remember thinking that like the heaviness of it didn't work, because it like the quickness of XCOM, the like the, you know, making a move and then deciding to take it back and then like testing, like just couldn't translate, because like the kind of game that I wanted to play wasn't necessarily like, wanting to make a space marine feel good in heft doesn't necessarily also translate to a good video game. So hopefully it works.
One of the big problems with space marines is they can also run like way faster than anybody. The Demon Hunters game, which is like XCOM, gets that a lot better. And if you want something that doesn't do that, that's still XCOM-y, then you want Mechanicus, which is also very good. But yeah, like they're a massive challenge to get right, and that's why it's so like wonderful to see that Saber have got it right, at least from what we can see in 3 minutes trailer.
Yeah, I mean, Demon Hunters, I really like. I think is a great game. It does have a bit of Buzz Lightyear about it, though. I think, especially when they're sort of smashing through walls and things. But yeah. This looks so, so good. And, yeah, I was actually surprised by the winter release window. I thought it was going to be pushed back relatively significantly because we've seen so little of it. But if they stick to that, and that's a reasonable time frame for it to come out in a good place, cannot wait.
Well, speaking about a surprising amount of heft... Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is coming out on two discs.
So what? I think the original one came out on two discs, isn't it? So Remake was on two discs as well.
But, so that's three discs so far.
That is two discs of PlayStation 5 quality gizmos, basically. Yeah, wonderful for anyone that still uses physical.
Me.
I saw this trending on Twitter last night as it emerged that the game was coming out in two discs. And it just made me think like back to when the original Final Fantasy VII came out, and you know, the sort of jewel cases, the PS1 jewel cases that had to have all those discs in them. I was working Electronics Boutique, if you remember that, back in the day, and having to take all that crap out of a jewel case, shrink wrap it, and put. I was like, oh god! But so I'm getting flashbacks to like old
people at CEX now are like, oh my god!
Yeah, but I think it's kind of fun. It's a throwback, it's a novel, miss a novelty.
I remember when Red Dead Redemption 2 came out and being really surprised that there were multiple discs in that, because like, a lot of the games that obviously were on the PS4 generation just weren't, were they? Like, a Blu-ray was big enough. But to get Red Dead when it came on multiple discs was kind of like a throwback to... I grew up on PC games, which were all multiple. Every game I pretty much owned. Even Monkey Island came on two discs. Like, Monkey Island 3 had a disc swap halfway through it. So yeah, it is kind of a nostalgia bait, isn't it, for people of a certain age?
Yeah, I mean, the question is this really necessary? Like, you know, from a physical like space that you need for this game, can it fit on it? Like, is it truly necessary, or is it like, you know, aren't they having a bit of fun with it? What will be really interesting to see is the inevitable headlines that come when they announce how much of a hard drive this game will take up. Because, you know, for it to be across two PS5 discs, you know, it's going to need to be, you know, 200 gig, something stupid
I'm trying to think, what was the deal with Jedi Survivor? Is there nothing on the disc for Jedi Survivor? Was that the headline for that? Because Jedi Survivor is about 148 gig. And I can't remember if there was like basically nothing on the disc, or if there is enough on the disc to be considered a full game. Because obviously so much of it now is you put the disc in and just download the rest.
Yeah.
But if this is two discs, is it just because quite a lot of games these days require two discs, if you actually put all of the game on a disc rather than having a massive day one patch?
Yeah.
So you're saying like a base PS5 that isn't connected to the internet at all, can you still play it but with like reduced textures?
Yeah,
maybe. I like it personally. I just want an extra thing. Give me a freebie.
Yeah, maybe the second disc is just like cool, fun, off-cut stuff.
Yes, yeah, it's one you can show off to your friends.
Yeah, loads of games used to be like that, didn't they? They'd have like a second disc full of behind-the-scenes stuff and weird things. I used to love all that.
Yeah. Bring back two discs. I mean, they are, so I'm out.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it. Or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Pete? There are two more big ones I think we should talk about. So
I will just point out, I do think Final Fantasy looks really good, and I've got some stuff on the site about it, probably about now.
Yeah, you also got your
inside
investigative piece coming out
this weekend. If you like Final Fantasy, you've played Final Fantasy VII before, you might want to check out the site from about 5 p.m. on Saturday, because I'll have one of those big inside stories up, big community deep dive.
Exciting.
I'm looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. I haven't read it yet, but it's right up my street.
You definitely don't want to read it unless you know the story of Final Fantasy VII. It's a very deep look at some of the fairly massive plot points in that game.
Mm-hmm. Well, something also that you've worked very hard on is taking a look at Lies of P previously, which finally got a release date announcement.
Yeah, stayed up late. Well, I don't actually know what the release date is. What did they say it was?
I'd have to look it up.
September,
or is it October?
September, because I think it was pushed back from August.
Yes, of course. So it is coming out on September the 19th, and they shadow dropped a demo as part of Keeley's big show. So yeah, I spent a lot of my night playing that, and it is pretty good. I think it is. It's absolutely a From Software ripoff.
It's the Bloodborne we have at home.
Well, what I'd actually say, the surprising thing is it's very Bloodborne in its environment design, because it's obviously Victorian Gothic, in which you play as, you know, this Pinocchio little boy, and everybody's...
Timothée Chalamet.
Yeah, basically.
Oh,
Timothée
God,
Chalamet.
He looks like... Yeah. That's remarkable how similar they are.
Yeah, very much so. And then the world is full of these creepy puppets. I actually think it plays closer to Dark Souls, largely because you have a block. And obviously the big thing about Bloodborne is that you can't block attacks. It's entirely a dodge-based system. So it's surprising how a single mechanic alters the way that you think about it. But it is quick, like Bloodborne is. You know, it's faster than any of the Souls games. Well, maybe probably on par with 3. But yeah, in terms of, it's very clearly everything about it pulls on the Souls games and Bloodborne. It kind of has a slightly like regain system like Bloodborne has, where lots of good strike, faster attacks will, you know, get you some health. You can refill your equivalent of an Estus flask by kind of damaging things. Lots and lots of stuff that's about it. But what I will say is it's the first kind of clone of a Souls game that actually felt like it captured the essence of Souls. And so I don't mind. It doesn't feel cheap because of it. Whereas kind of something like... The funny thing is this is exactly like Steel... Steel Rising, is it? That there was the Spiders game? Yeah. Which was obviously them wanting to do a steampunk Bloodborne, basically. And that very much does feel like it's a kind of like, you know, the Tesco value version of what FromSoft do. Because it's so similar in so many ways, but they've clearly not got the budget and not necessarily like the very deep mechanical understanding of those games to quite do like a really good homage to it. Whereas whoever's made this like understands those games. It really did feel like if you just told me that Miyazaki made this, I think I might believe you. And so, yeah, it's good, at least from the kind of two levels that are in that demo. I liked it. It's got some own little kind of like ideas. So your weapon is constantly blunting, basically. So you have on your arm a grinding wheel that you run your weapon
it's
up
Monster
and down.
Hunter.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Monster Hunter. Hell yeah.
So you have to sharpen your weapon. It's one of those that kind of like your weapon will really deteriorate in a boss fight. So you either have to kind of create the space between you and the boss to sharpen the weapon, or spend a consumable, like, instant sharpen thing. And then he's got, like, this thing called the puppet string, which is the Sekiro vibe. The arm has got different things that you can slot into it, of which the one that you get in the demo is this, like, grappling hook that you can fire into enemies and pull them towards you and then stab them. You have, like, a fable gauge, which allows you to do special attacks once you've, like, built up the gauge and stuff like that. So there are bits of it that have its own like sprinkling of flavor on the top of the very traditional FromSoft formula. But that combined with it feels tight, it feels responsive, I like the combat. And goddamn if steampunk Victorian puppet freaks is not my cup of tea for a vibe. yeah, like I genuinely really liked it and it's on Game Pass, so it's going to be free.
Yes, mate. You get an impression why Pinocchio...
No, but what I will say is there's a lying mechanic that they haven't really explained how it works. But this one, what I would say is in comparison to like your Dark Souls, this is a little bit more narratively rich in terms of, not that Dark Souls isn't narratively rich, because of course it is, but you have to do a lot of digging in Dark Souls to find it. This has a more traditional, like it's presented in front of your face. And so there's what I get the impression might be a little bit of its kind of BioWare nod in that lying is a dialogue choice. And when you lie, so for example, you have to go to a big hotel and puppets aren't allowed in the hotel, but because you are not a normal puppet, you can lie to get in. And when you lie, it comes up kind of like almost like the Telltale style thing, like all of the internal mechanisms inside you are like grinding up because you're lying. Like it's like you feel the tension of the lie. And I'm interested, like, if you keep lying, what happens to Pinocchio? Like, is he just gonna like self-combust?
But his nose doesn't
I wanna
get
see it.
No. What they do though is that the loading screen is the loading bar is his nose.
Oh my God, that's good.
And instead of saying now loading, it says now lying. And just the nose grows across the screen. So that's quite fun.
That's quite cute.
That is good.
So yeah, I'm very interested to see what the actual lying mechanic is, and if kind of like, you know, I've only lied once because that's the only opportunity I got in the demo, does the nose come into it, or is that going to be kind of like a folklore element of the game? I don't know, but I'm intrigued to see what that kind of narrative thing plays into a FromSoft style game, which obviously traditionally is just very mechanical rather than narrative.
I'm up for it. I'm up for another game I don't have time to play. I don't know if either of you, did you watch the Devolver Showcase?
I have not caught up yet.
Some of it. I tried.
It was very good. We got an opportunity to see the return of our favourite video game mascot, Volvi. He's back. But we also got to see, I think my favourite of the stuff that was shown off on this was the new game by the Ape Out and by Bennett Foddy of Co-op and Getting Over It fame. It's called Baby Steps. It's about being a 35-year-old man who didn't really get off the couch for a couple of years and is now independently controlling... You are independently controlling each leg.
So is it like a proper game version of Co-op then, basically?
Yes, yeah. Absolutely, with a kind of narrative element to it as well.
Cool.
Yep. It's about getting up hills. And it looks really, really great. I mean, I love Co-op anyway. Like, and GURP as well was really cool. I'm a Bennett Foddy head. I want to make that be on the record for the podcast. Now people know.
It sounds like the absolute like challenge it was for me to come out of the house after 2 years of lockdown.
Yeah, that's totally it. I can totally imagine that's an inspiration.
I did watch the trailer for this and I wasn't really sure what I was saying because I was sort of dipping in and out of the show at the time. It's very late. And I remember thinking, that character looks like a night out in Croydon, and I'm trying desperately to find my way home. It was like the walk home from the pub game.
Yeah, I've lived it.
Everything is not quite working right.
That's it. It's because it's an incredibly relatable experience is why it's resonating with me. Well, I was going to talk about The Flash, but I think we'll save that for another week because I think more people should see it so we can get into a little bit more of an in-depth conversation. My short thing is it's a genuine recommendation from me to check this movie out. I think it's very strange in a way that people are probably not expecting. But let's talk about it with spoilers, I think, at another time. The thing I would like to do, Wesley, if you could scroll down in the little document that I've given you and read out this little piece of feedback, we can get into the real meat of what I'm here to do this week.
Oh my god!
Mm-hmm.
I've already got feedback. Day five. Okay. Hey, IGN UK crew, first time, long time, etc. Couldn't help but notice you guys didn't speak about Street Fighter. Oh, I see. About Street Fighter 6, even though the episode came out in the same day. I love fighting games, but I have come to realize that they seem to be a bit of a niche sell. Why do you guys think this is? What makes a fighting game player? Would love to hear the crew's opinion on this. Respect the sea, Joe from Southend. Oh, the respect the sea bit makes sense now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important. Yep. Yeah, that's your first respect the sea as well. I have to hope that you do respect the sea, otherwise it's...
I live by the sea. I live on the south coast, so yeah. Big respect to the sea.
Nice. Everybody in the audience just popped to that. They were like, yeah, he said it.
This is like the podcast lore that I need to catch up on.
Even I don't fully get it, but I'm happy that they're happy.
This email clearly came in. Were you on this episode, Matt? Because you like fighting games, but I think the problem in terms of why we didn't speak about it is A, we didn't get any Street Fighter code in advance, so we couldn't have spoken about it that week, and B, quite a lot of us know very little about fighting games. However, we now have two fighting game people, so everything's been solved.
Yeah, I think Street Fighter 6 is utterly brilliant from what I've been playing so far. I think that there are so many interesting mechanical decisions, and I think the World Tour stuff is really funny and silly. I'm really very excited to dig into it and make a weird like combo, create a character, and get into some of the avatar battles in the arcade sections. How about you, Wes? How you finding it so far?
It's tremendous. It is superb. One of the greatest fighting games of all time. And I think that Capcom's done a quite incredible job addressing this very point that was raised here, which is the inherent inaccessibility of fighting game genre. And there's been so many developers who've tried in the past to address this. And they've spent a lot of time and energy with tutorials, you know, onboarding stuff, without addressing the fundamental issues.
I think Skullgirls was the first one that I played that really tried to explain mechanics. Like, it was like, here's why you want to use these at these certain points. But even then, didn't quite have the tools that this one has to be able to decide, like, you know, even for yourself to be able to go, like, this combo will work because I can see from the frame data of this that I've got an extra 4 frames and I know that a punch will take 4 frames, so I can, you know, lob that in at the end.
Well, so this is the thing. This is the problem. It's the problem isn't that people can't understand the mechanics or they can't understand why certain things should be doing what they should be doing. The problem is that fighting games are inherently difficult to control because you have so much to consider. The input commands, generally speaking, are much more complex than any other video game genre to perform an action that you would consider to be useful in a competitive sense. Right, just when you think about, let's say, a first-person shooter, the act of shooting is a button press. Right, the act of aiming and shooting is 2 button presses. And that's, you know, you move around, but that's generally it. Like MOBAs, which are very difficult, really, it's not because they're difficult to control. It's because they're complex in terms of, like, you know, systems and items and other things you need to know to play the games. Fighting games are inherently difficult to control. You know, you've got six buttons for Street Fighter you do that are different attacks. And then input commands, which
and then
can
even
be
so
very,
those
very
buttons.
Difficult. Yeah.
Like, if you press 2 buttons, sometimes that becomes a totally different move.
Exactly.
And yeah. Those 2 buttons are different depending on which character you're playing as well. Like that. Ugh.
And that, yeah. That is why I think Street Fighter VI is a genuine, like, genuinely successful attempt to address this problem. Because they've added the modern control system. It's just like M. You see it on top of the screen when you're playing, people are using it, and they, Capcom rightly, do not split matchmaking by those who pick classic controls and those who pick modern. Everyone's in the same matchmaking pool, and that's the right decision because you don't want newcomers or people using it to feel like they're second class citizens or they're being looked down upon.
And I do think you could probably get really far with modern controls if you know your solid fundamentals. Unfortunately, at the minute, not a lot of them do, but we'll get there. But if you are new to fighting games and you don't want to learn combos to begin with, you just want to get your fundamentals down, you want to learn how to, like, you know, tech a grab or, like, you know, what beats a sweep, like that sort of thing, you need to know to be able to play. But to lower the barrier of entry down to be able to then decide that you want to learn combos at some point, you've got it now. You can actually be involved and getting it, like, you can get down to the bare fundamentals now.
Yeah, you can actually play the game, which is a thing that we've spent 30 years trying to work out how to do. And it's fantastic. Like, and learning what beats what is all competitive video games. Like, that as a concept is not inherently difficult or inherently uniquely difficult to Street Fighter. Like, you know, in Call of Duty, picking the gun that beats the opponent for the sort of range that you're having in a gunfight in is all part of learning the game. And, you know, MOBAs, you know, what is the ability that I should be using? But they're just clicks, they're just one button presses or whatever. So being able to almost turn Street Fighter into a game that you can control almost effortlessly in the same similar sense to other genres opens up the things that are exciting about it, which is the mind games and the spacing and knowing what beats what in certain situations and what to use when, that makes those sort of considerations, things that make fighting games great, available to everyone. Because no one's playing Street Fighter because they really enjoy doing the input command for a spin pile driver. Like, no one's like, I really love doing a 360-degree motion and pressing a button. People are like, I really want to play Street Fighter because I want to do that move to my opponent and, you know, psych them out, but with a mix-up following it. That's the stuff that people really love. If you just give that opportunity to more people, then you're sort of solving these problems. So that's why I think it's a really successful game.
Mm-hmm. There's so much, like, small stuff in it that I find myself really enjoying too. Like, certain, like, animation delivery is, like, it's polished to a shine. I think about how, like, good the Manon like super is, where like you get a grab and then she's like a ballet dancer, so she's posing you in ballet positions as the camera's cutting, and it's just, it's funny every time. Like, this really has like a fun sense of humor to it that, like, totally disconnected from any of the competitive stuff, it's just fun to look at.
I mean, you mentioned the single player campaign earlier, World Tour. Capcom's having a laugh of this game. Like, it's completely out there. And I finished the campaign, and my favorite bit of it is when I got a text message from Rhea, who apparently has never sent a text message before. And he signs all of his text messages Rhea. And you That's have dialogue great. Options. You can choose to go, mate, you don't have to sign every single text that you get. Or you can choose to say, you're doing great, you're just learning how to text, keep at it. And I'm like, what game am I playing?
I'm doing a Ryu dating sim right now.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've never been said anything like that before about Street Fighter game. It's really great.
It's great. Play Street Fighter. Even if you don't think you'd like it, you might find something here. I'm genuinely thinking about going to a session to play it with people on Sunday, like in person.
Ooh.
Which I would never do before. Like, I really liked Street Fighter 4. I didn't really get into 5 for whatever reason, though I did play a little bit of it. But 6 has me feeling some ways.
Who do you mean?
Oh, I'm a Ken player.
Oh, we were getting on so well.
Yeah, no, he just feels right. No one else kind of like... There's this saying that you should like pick a character that fits your hands, and he's like always just feels correctly for me.
Well, you're part of the problem.
I'm good, though, is the thing. Anybody that just, wants to, spam Hadouken into Shoryu when you jump over, like, nah, thank you. I actually try and play the game.
So you're not
a
flowchart, Ken. I wrote a story for IGN today, or the day we're recording this, about players who've worked out the most popular characters on Street Fighter VI. I mean, it's only one week in, and Ken is at the top. Ken is the most popular character. So if you want, if or playing online, you're running into a lot of Kens. He's really strong in this game, though, to be fair.
He's got so many options, honestly. Like, and every combo having a little, like, dash option too, and his dash also gives him an, like, advancement to all of his, like, specials too, is, like, it's just fun. I've been thinking about Marisa, though. Like, I think that the, like, having armor on basically every attack is, like...
Oh, it's so good to beat the drive stuff.
Yeah, they think they've got you, but you just do something that you normally do against it, and they don't have anything for it. It's like, it's no better feeling. Yeah, it's just, like, just doing cool stuff. The little tiny things that I've noticed about them doing, like, stuff with taunts, that, like, Lily's taunt will block a fireball. It's just so silly.
I didn't
silly.
Know that,
like,
actually.
Yeah, yeah. Because she's got a little camera, and so the camera flash is technically a projectile. And it does a single point of damage.
That's enough.
Yeah.
So you could imagine killing someone with that. That's the ultimate insult.
The last. Yeah, yeah, it'd be great. Yeah, it's stuff like that. It's like, you don't need to include something like that, but it is funny that you've done it, is the stuff I love.
It feels like we're having a really great time with fighting games generally at the moment. Like, we just saw Mortal Kombat at Summer Game Fest, and I think that looks really great. I really loved the last Mortal Kombat, so I've got every reason to believe it will be. And that's coming out later this year. We've got Tekken 8 coming soon, and that looks really promising as well. Arc System Works' fighting games are fantastic. Guilty Gear Strive is great. The Dragon Ball fighting game they made is superb. It's a really, really good time for fighting games at the moment, I think.
Absolutely.
So much to play.
I also don't think that there's a better entry point than this one. Like, get this. This is the game if you want to ever, figure out if you like fighting games or not, and then you can check the other ones out. Hell yeah. All right, I think we got another little bit of feedback. If you want to jump on that one.
Me, yes, I can come in. So this one is from Daniel from Adelaide in South Australia, who says, "Gents, hope you're all well, except for Joe, who's a twat and doesn't like praise." Well, Daniel, Joe hasn't worked for us for about 6 months at this point, so you don't have to worry about insulting him at this point.
He's not listening either.
I'd like to tell you about an unfortunate situation I found myself in. My in-laws were visiting from out of town, and I hadn't seen them for a year or so. Before they were due to arrive at my house, I was watching the Mel Brooks film The Producers, the 2005 remake. Having not knowing anything about the film, only that it was considered a comedy classic, I was very unassuming about the movie's plot. Needless to say, I was quite enjoying the absurd premise about the stage show glorifying the Nazis. However, it was at the very scene where Hitler was rising from under the stage, being flagged by the Nazi eagle and swastikas, in which my in-laws came in and I was cackling away. Their jaws dropped. I had to hastily explain what movie it was and the context surrounding it, but thankfully they were good sports about it and didn't think too differently of me. This begs the question, have you guys ever found yourself in a situation where you've been watching something completely fine, but someone comes in at the wrong time and you have to sheepishly explain that it's fine and you're not some weirdo? All the best from Daniel in Adelaide. And for flying fuck, respect the sea.
I watch anime, so... yeah, that's a short answer to that one.
Pretty much. I don't think I've ever had anything... that comes to mind like immediately, but what I will say is, in a similar-ish boat, I was on the plane the other week going somewhere, and I was playing Zelda and basically spent the entire time avoiding ever going to the Great Fairies, because their visuals and the noise that they make is a little bit of the sort of vibe that I don't really want while there's someone that doesn't understand video games sat next to me. They sound like they're having a bit too much of a good time in that flower.
They are. That's canonical.
Okay, there we go.
I'm trying to think, like, this isn't exactly the right the same situation, but it's just hearing you read that out, this just brought flashbacks to this for me, which is God, I can't believe I'm going to talk about this. I think it was eight maybe, and I'd gone to bed, and then woke up. And you know, when you're a kid and you sort of like creep downstairs, and your parents are watching something that is for grown-ups, and you know, because it's, well, of course they should. I'm a parent now, and they were watching Jean-Claude Van Damme's Kickboxer.
Nice. Yeah.
And I don't think that they saw me, but I ever so slightly opened the living room door so I could watch the telly while they were watching the movie as well. And I got a decent chunk of it watching it from that perspective. And at the end of that movie, there's like two sets of kickboxers that are sort of competing. I doubt anyone has seen this movie, but there's two sets of kickboxers in a tournament, and they've been rivals throughout the entire film, and you know, very bitter rivals. And at the very end, the winning team gives the other team their winning medals, and they're all like friends. And I burst out crying. It was so emotional. It was like one of the saddest, most heart. Like, it was so, oh my God, I can't believe. And I remember my parents both, I can still see it now, turned their heads on the sofa, looked at me, and was like, what are you doing watching this? You should not be watching, because it's quite violent. And I was in floods of tears because it was such an emotional ending to the movie, and I got caught watching Kickboxer when I shouldn't have, and I basically ran upstairs back to bed. That's the only thing. This is bringing flashbacks to that to me.
That's adorable.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be a kickboxer after that, and I don't think my parents thought that was adorable.
I feel like mine was too much of a cop-out, and you've also reminded me of something that, I think the first anime that I ever watched that wasn't, like, Pokemon, was the, like, notorious UK dub of a show called Urusei Yatsura, which is also called Invader Lum, at least it was in the UK. So the BBC put on like two episodes of it that they dubbed by like Matt Lucas and Lauren Laverne. And it's really, really good. You can't find it now. It's occasionally will go up on YouTube for a little bit. But there's a bit of it where a plot point of the first episode is that the girl gets her bra stolen, and I'm like up late at night at like 10 o'clock watching this. I'm like, this is amazing. I've never seen an animation like this before. But also there's a bit where like a girl is topless in it, and I'm just like scanning the room. I'm like flicking to other channels constantly and like half watching it because I know I'm going to get in trouble. So I'm like watching it for a little bit and then changing the channels just so that I don't get in trouble if somebody walks in. Yep.
God.
Mm-hmm.
Not really that sneaky, is it, Matt?
No, not at all. Anyway, check out the UK dub of Urusei Yatsura if you ever get a chance. It's very funny. I also got a tiny little bit of feedback as well, saying, and this one is from Adam, who says, you had some feedback last week for somebody who was looking for suggestions on what to get their partner to play. My fiancé... Oh, can I take that one once more? My fiancé is relatively new to being a gamer. Some of the games she's found easier to get into are the Resident Evil games. Resident Evil 2 or older titles such as Resident Evil Revelations often have a slower pace of gameplay and on easier difficulty levels can be much kinder to new players in regards to taking damage. They also have a tendency that when you take damage, you are given a relatively generous window to get away. Now, on to the real feedback. I'm sick of game chat on my food podcast. Not long ago, I was at a party with a group of friends and a group of people I wasn't familiar with who got rather merry. The following morning, having slept at the house party I was at and hanging out of my ass, I stumbled downstairs and ate a large amount of the leftover ham and mushroom pizza in the kitchen. Turns out, the mushrooms were not of the chestnut variety. I spent a very strange Sunday tripping in a chair while my friends apparently routinely checked on my well-being. This leads me to my question. What is the strangest topping that you've had on a pizza?
Probably Adam requires explaining here that we talk a lot about food on this podcast.
We don't mean to, but yeah. Then suddenly we end up doing it.
Yeah, no, sounds good to me. I mean, food's got fans too, right?
Mm-hmm. I got an easy answer for this one. There's a place near me called Crate, right by the river in Hackney Wick. It does a potato and sage pizza.
I was about to say roast potato is the most interesting thing I've had on. Not that, obviously, it's anywhere near.
Yeah, it's so good.
Roast potatoes on pizza.
So they were sliced roast potatoes with gorgonzola. It was delightful.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
There was a little bit where, this was a couple of years ago now, but Pizza Hut did a roast dinner pizza, which was really good.
That sounds a bit too, I don't mind the potatoes, but the idea of like a whole, like what's it got, like slices of roast beef on it and stuffing and like carrots.
Gravy?
I think it was like red onion sauce as well. It was pretty good. Yeah. Oh, I could have that right now. I need to go back in time to be able to have a roast dinner pizza.
Sounds terrible to me, all of it.
But if you're ever in Hackney Wick, summertime, you might be right by the canal. Have a potato and sage pizza. You won't regret it. It's like sliced, like grated potato as well. So it's almost as if it's the cheese. It's very.
But then
very
it's
nice.
Not the cheese, though, is it?
No,
it's potato.
Grated potato. Yeah.
Oh God.
Oh, it's good.
I don't think I've had
I want
anything
one now.
Weird.
I might do that tomorrow.
I don't think I've had anything. I'm very very safe when it comes to pizzas. And I usually just go for Fiorentina every single time. I love an egg on a pizza, so I'm very boring, extremely boring.
See, I think some people would think that an egg was adventurous, though, right? Like, if you consider pizza is basically like pepperoni, then the egg, it's wild.
Well, you get, like, this is a standard option. You know, like, it's on all the menus, so I wouldn't call it strange. Certainly not like your horrific roast beef monstrosity, but
it's a fried egg, right?
Yeah.
If it was scrambled egg, that'd be weird.
that'd be disgusting, I think. Yeah. Just throw some like more fried breakfast on there. Why not? I can't think of a crazy topping that I've had on a pizza.
Yeah.
There used to pizza that I used to get occasionally when I used to live in Bath from a really, really great place there called The Oven, which is like owned by an Italian family. And they did one that's got like jam and walnuts and loads of rocket on it, which is actually quite
really
nice.
Good. It's like a Waldorf salad, I guess. Then,
sort of. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I could do
that. But obviously with a lot of cheese and tomato sauce and bread underneath it.
Mate, I've realised I'll eat pretty much anything, honestly. I don't think I've got a sense of what's bad and what's good. If it's in front of me, I'm happy.
Jam on a pizza, I don't know. There's too many things that it could sort of like bleed into that you typically get on a pizza. That's putting me off a little bit. You know, like the idea of getting like baked beans with other things on your plate that might have similar consistency in it.
But sure.
Baked bean pizza, if you want to.
Oh, God, imagine.
Question for the audience, I think. What's the weirdest meal to put an egg on? What meal would you never want to eat an egg with? And I think that'll just about do it for us. Wes, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
I hope you have a long and illustrious career.
Depending on what I think of the prestige. It all depends on what I think about prestige.
Yeah, it might be shorter than you think if that's that question isn't answered the correct way. Thank you so much for joining us. The feedback email, if you want to send us anything, is
IGN_UKfeedback@IGN.com.
I never do this. But thank you so much for joining us. What music are we having this week?
Street Fighter music, it feels like we've done a lot of Street Fighter chat this week.
Yeah, so. The music is real. The character select theme's really good, actually. Maybe we'll do that if we can find that.
And Guile's theme does go with everything. So.
Oh, yeah, Guile's theme then. Oh, if we can find a way to make it... You know the Spider-Man 2 pizza song? If I could find a way to match up the two of those, I'll do that at the end here. All right, bye.
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 Nowadays, trends and news cycles change faster than we can blink. But there are some things that withstand the test of time. And if you're looking for a connection to something timeless, and maybe also a glimpse of life at a slower pace, I believe everyone can relate to the very human experiences explored in Jane Austen's novels. And that's where I come in. My name is Alison Larkin. I'm a writer, comedian, and narrator and host of The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin. I spent a lot of my childhood in the part of England where Jane Austen lived and wrote, and now that I live in the States, nothing gives me a sense of homecoming quite like narrating her books. On this show, you'll listen to award-winning narration. I'll give myself a pat on the back for that. As well as conversations with actors, writers, and other fascinating people who all share a passionate love for Jane Austen. So please, join me as we embark on a wonderful journey through Jane Austen's work. Be sure to listen and subscribe to The Jane Austen Podcast with Alison Larkin, wherever you get your podcasts.